Genesis chapter 50. I'm going to read beginning at verse 15 down to verse 22. Genesis 50, 15 to 22. Very, very familiar and beloved story. You remember Joseph, the story of Joseph. He was the favorite of his father, and so he gave him that coat of many colors, and that coat provoked the jealousy of his brothers, and that jealousy led them to want to do away with him. And as they were seeking to do away with him, a better idea arose. And some slave traders happened to be coming by, and he gave them to them. And when they traded him off, a man by the name of Potiphar bought him, and who happened to have a wife who was quite the scoundrel and lied about Joseph and got him into trouble, and he was put in a dungeon. And there was good news. There was a chief cupbearer and who got released. And but one of them died, and the other was restored. The cupbearer was back to his place. He had hoped that he would tell him about Joseph and lift him up out of there, which didn't happen. He was abandoned again, but there was a famine, and they knew that this man in prison had had the dreams and could interpret them, and Pharaoh had a dream, so he was pulled up for that purpose. He interpreted the dream, he ascended power, and his now brothers and father needed food, so they came there, and they were all together again there. He reveals himself to them eventually. Jacob and all of them come to Egypt. That's how Israel wound up in the land of Egypt. And at the very end, after Jacob dies, Joseph's brothers realize that things may not be like they were at every past Christmas for the family now that Dad is gone. And so it reads in verse 15 of chapter 50, when Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph bears a grudge against us, you think, and pays us back in full for all the wrong which we did to him?" A fearful prospect. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father charged before he died, saying, 'Thus you shall say to Joseph.'" They're hoping he cares about this one a lot more than we care about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's final wish. "Please forgive, I beg you, the transgression of your brothers and their sin, for they did you wrong. And now, please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." You like how they put it? Dad asked for this, and they somehow had to add in, "We're the servants of the God of your father," you know. And it says, Joseph wept when they spoke to him. Then his brothers also came, and so it wasn't clear how he was going to respond. And this time they went ahead and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants, your slaves." And now Joseph opens his mouth, and he said to them, "Do not be afraid. For am I in God's place? As for you, You meant evil against me. He didn't sugarcoat it, did he? He didn't say, oh, it's okay. We all make mistakes. No. You wronged me. What you did was evil. And you meant the evil. But God meant it for good. In order to, he gives a specific good, bring about this present result to preserve many people alive. Lord willing, we will eventually get back to Ephesians, the study of Ephesians. I have never, rarely ever in all my preaching career, preached topical messages and series. And I have definitely not had one get away from me this much. I think this is part 13. So I'm hoping we don't get into the 20s. I was intending this one to be the last one, and believe it or not, there's been several times where I felt like Moses and thought, we've gone around this mountain long enough. Let's go back. In my own heart, I love going verse by verse, phrase by phrase, and so I'm least comfortable doing a topical series. But I have been thankful and encouraged. Several of you have expressed gladness in it and edification from it. And so that encourages a preacher's heart and labor. We know that we can ask useless questions in theology. In the Middle Ages, there was actually, it's a proverb now, but it actually happened where some people sat around wondering and trying to figure out how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. And so that would be a useless kind of question to consider, right? Prior to that, one of the men that actually taught Paul, Gamaliel, there's a famous debate between Hillel and Gamaliel where they actually debated each other and had hours of discussion on whether or not it was right to eat an egg that had been laid by a chicken on the Sabbath, because the chicken had to work to lay that egg on the Sabbath. So was it lawful to eat an egg? Chicken happened to lay on the Sabbath. So we hope that these questions that we're considering and spending our time on in response to the doctrine of predestination are not useless. We're trying to answer the ones that we all genuinely, honestly ask whenever we hear this doctrine. I, as well as you, and everyone that came before you, and everyone that will come after you, there are these questions that we ask. And they are anxious to us. They're serious questions, some of them. They touch on our view of God, our view of the gospel. We feel it. It can send us in totally different directions in our Christian life. So these are the ones that we hope to deal with. And so that's where we're at. We're trying to wrap it up with answering some questions that we ask when we hear this doctrine. The two we covered so far was, is last time, is predestination double? And then second, is predestination and injustice? Today, I had planned to cover two, but we're only going to cover one. And part of the reason is because we have the Lord's Supper today. So a pastor has a little more difficulty with his series. They're constantly having to weave in and segue into other things that are part of a local church, and that's a blessing, as we'll see. But the one, the two I had scheduled was, is predestination determinism? And what about the foreknowledge verses? Does foreknowledge support the non-reformed view of predestination? But all we're going to deal with today is predestination determinism? Now, this thought, you may not feel like all of you ask it. Maybe some of you do. Some of you think about it. But it sort of is in the vein of, when you hear predestination, it sounds like everything is determined. It sounds like all of your actions are pointless. It sounds something like fatalism. And is that what we're meaning to teach? And so this question gets raised. And my first thought on this question to mention is that the question assumes a couple of things. Number one, it assumes that determinism is a bad thing. And number two, it assumes predestination is the only worldview out there teaching determinism. And so let's get the definition first, right? What is determinism? Determinism is the view that human destiny and life, from birth all the way through, are not determined by you, ultimately, and your choices, but by something or someone else. By something or someone else. And what I want to share with you is that predestination, yes, teaches a form of determinism. But the reason I say a form of it is because there are lots of forms of determinism, and also because every single worldview teaches one of these forms. There are no non-deterministic worldviews. So we come again to that question. It's not a question of whether, but which. Whether you will hold to a form of determinism, but which one you will hold to. Now, when people, the first one I'll address, when people mention this, they almost use the synonym fatalism for determinism in the question. So fatalism, we'll take that one first. It is a form of determinism. Historically, it comes from Greek, old Greek goddess and sort of thing. There were three women, we'll call them the Golden Girls, Greek goddesses, called the Fates. And there are these little reliefs, these artistic reliefs on certain buildings and such where you see them. There were three women. One of them, and they all three together did something with a cloth. And this cloth represented an individual's life. And so the first one spun the cloth, basically made it, whatever kind it is and texture. The other drew it out, basically, and that represented giving the life. And then the final one cut the cloth, which represented death. And so Greeks talked about fates. Everyone had a fate. And the task of life was to interact with the gods in such a way to sort of, in a final destination way, sort of, if you remember that old movie, sort of beat the game and make your fate a different way. And there's this tussle back and forth with the gods. And these three kind of do it, but other gods can kind of mess it up. And your life is really in the hands of the days of our gods, kind of. Just they're having their romances and fights, and one of them gets mad and throws a thunderbolt down, and it killed somebody you loved. And it's that kind of a thing, these capricious, whimsical, sub-deities, kind of halfway gods and goddesses are running everyone's life. Well, predestination is not that. If you think of Colossians chapter 1 in verse 16, Paul makes it a point to tell the Colossians this very thing. They were being bombarded with angels and spirits and all this kind of thing. People were having revelations and they were fearful, made to fear these angels and spirits. And that's why in Colossians 1, Paul writes to tell them in his exaltation of Christ in verse 16 that by him, that is Jesus, the Son, all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. So, he is in control of all of whatever you may think is a so-called God. So predestination is not that. We're not to have the thought that our lives are just being whimsically thrown around by a capricious person who is simply more powerful than us. That's fatalism. The more modern example would be, you could call it geneticism, a materialistic worldview, where basically you could sum it up like this. Almost everyone in society is pushed to have this worldview today, that the personal reduces to the impersonal. So if you want to really understand me, then you have to break me down into crystals and then compounds and atoms and subatomic particles and even go further than that. And if you understand my proton and neutron arrangement and my electron movements, then you understand Jeffrey, because I am ultimately nothing but rearranged matter. And so this is the geneticism form of determinism, that everything is a result. It's really just like the fates. Instead of your this cloth being rolled out, right? Your genes are rolled out and coiled up, and there you are. You're born with this kind of malady or that one, or you won the genetic lottery like Jordan and you're good at basketball, and you lost the genetic lottery and you're not good at basketball. Everything is determined by genes. Predestination is also not that. How do we know that? Same verse Paul used for the Colossians. Look at what he says in verse 17. Says, he is before all things. So he was there before the genes were there. And in him all things hold together. He calls him in verse 18, where it says, the beginning. He is the beginning. The word is the arche, and it's exactly what Elsa is on Frozen 2. In Greek thinking, there was the four forces, right? Earth, air, fire, water. But then philosophers thought, what if there is a fifth force, a fifth essence, as they tried to get down to the essence of things? What is everything really made of? And so they thought water, and then they thought air, and they thought fire, and then they thought, and they went on earth. But then they said, what if there is a fifth one called a quintessence? So we have that term. that holds all the other four together. So I'm sorry to tell you they plagiarized. That is not an original thought. But in that movie, Elsa is the Christ figure in that movie. All movies have one, a savior of some sort. All men's stories are spinoffs of the gospel story. And she holds everything together. So in that movie, the idea is not the personal reduces to the impersonal forces of earth, air, fire, and water, but there is a person underneath the impersonal forces of earth, air, fire, and water controlling those forces. That's the biblical worldview. Not personal to impersonal, but impersonal to personal. That there is a God under the atoms holding all things together. So it's not geneticism. That is a form of determinism that's out there. Another one is impersonal laws like math, physics, logic. The idea is there's laws of gravity and laws of motion and all these things that you see in the world. And if you ask a certain kind of secular scientist, he'll tell you that it basically everything is created by these laws, these impersonal abstractions and formulas. And you say, well, where were they before? You got them. How do you know them? Well, we know them from the material by looking at them. Or where were they before the material then, you know? But anyway, the idea that everything is basically created by these impersonal laws. That's one. It's not. We're not here. Math didn't create us. And a law of logic didn't create us. A formula is not responsible for what we see. Probably growing in popularity today more and more. Amazing. I never thought I would see it. A return to Eastern mysticism. We have horoscopes. It used to be sort of taboo, right, for a preacher to mention it. Kind of, oh, don't be legalistic. But there are really people going after that today. Oh, you're this and so am I. And you hear it in society today. And then you also hear the term universe, almost like people are trying to have an encouraging view of life, you know, like, well, things will work out. And for a long time, they just used the kind of abstract pronoun it. But now some are so bold, they say, well, the universe, what is that? The universe, there's just these forces out there moving things around. You just have to trust the universe. So, those are all forms of determinism. The final one is the word chance. Chance. This is a funny one. Aristotle mocked it, who was a pagan. He mocked it by saying chance. Someone asked him to define it. Chance is that which rocks think about. In other words, nothing. You could just as call it sumsi. There's sumsi. We're working it. What is that? I just invented a word, just a random word to kind of fill the void of God. Is what it is. Chance, there is no thing called chance. It is literally, in the philosophical sense of the word, a no thing, a nothing. And a no thing can do nothing. But basically what we think of it as is we flip a coin, you know, 100 times. And out of those 100 times, we find about 50% of the time it lands on tails, and 50% of the time it lands on heads, And so we say the chances of it falling one way or the other are 50-50. But ask yourself, what is it that causes that consistent result of that coin? You'd say, well, it's the stuff that it's made of. It's the law of gravity on the earth. Those consistent working things are what cause it to be so predictable. Guess what the Bible teaches? In Genesis 8 and in verse 22, after the flood, we read this, that while the earth remains, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease. Why is the earth about to create fall again through its tilt and its revolutions and all of that? Why is it going to create fall again? At the same time it did last year, right? Here we are again, another fall. Why is the sun going to go away again tonight? Round about same time as the last point at this year. There it is. And we have day and night, and we have spring and fall. Consistently, predictably, according to Scripture, because God is consistent and faithful. God keeps all things working in a consistent way. And so what we see as impersonal laws are simply, from a biblical worldview, the consistent actions of God. So he keeps gasoline being gasoline so it doesn't turn into water when you put it in your tank. Or he keeps water being water and it doesn't turn into gasoline when you put it in your throat. That's what Colossians means when it says he holds all things together. And what Genesis 8 means when it says he causes everything to be consistent. So why can we count on the coin falling half the time this way and half the time that way? Because we can count on God keeping the universe working the same way. Which is to say, the algorithms that support a casino ultimately rest on the faithfulness of God. That's why we can make those predictions, because of his consistency. So chance does nothing. In contrast to all of these attempts to remove God from our lips, predestination teaches us to reduce reality from the impersonal to the personal. So it does teach a form of determinism. But listen to this. I would much rather my life be determined by a personal, all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful, and all-wise Father than by an equation or chance or whimsical deities or genes. Think of a mother with a newborn. She determines everything. We were hearing from Justin and Casey, I don't know how many bows they already have. Like, the baby does not get to pick her bows that she's going to wear. It's all already determined. These bows and these outfits and what you're going to eat and how long you're going to eat it. And none of us look at that and say, oh, that poor child, everything is determined. No, we look on that as precious. And that's why in Psalm 139, David could say, "You have searched me and known me. You're intimately acquainted with all my ways. You know when I rise up and when I rise down." And mothers know that kind of stuff, like when was your last bowel movement and all that kind of stuff that no one else cares. They know everything, right? And then David says, "How precious are your thoughts to me. Oh God, how vast is the sum of them." He did not think of it as a bad thing. I think the reason we kick against it, though, is we confuse it with, we say, well, it's precious for a mom to be determining everything for her baby while they're from zero to somewhere, depending on what kind of worldview we have. We stop it somewhere. A secularist is going to stop it at like five, right? Now let the kid make all life decisions at six. But even someone thinking clear-headedly is going to, you know, around 17 or so or eight, they start lengthening the apron string, and now you're an adult, and there's got to be this shift, right, to where they become their own person. And nobody looks at that and says, "How precious, mom picking out all your food and making all your life decisions." But if you think about it, the reason for that is us adults are limited. We're not all wise. I mean, I can't know everything that is right for your life. I don't even know what's right for my own. Right? And we're not all loving either. Right? We have times where we just read, we mean evil. Be very bad to give one of us the full rights of everything at certain times. And so that's the reason we don't want other adults running our lives. Because it wouldn't be good. It couldn't be good. But God always sees all things. Always is all loving. Always is all good. Always is all wise. And I feel, I was telling Charlie this morning, that you can say you believe in providence, but it stays general. And in this study here, I'm noticing there are particulars to this doctrine. It's like saying, "Oh, I know about the Swiss Army knife." And by that, all you mean is you look at it, it's got the little symbol, but it's got like 100 little gadgets and gizmos on it, doesn't it? And what if you say, "Oh, I don't know any of them. I know it has the scissors. That's all I know. And a toothpick that normally gets lost." But if you don't know any of the other particulars, you would say, you know, you kind of affirm it, but you don't really know a lot about the Swiss Army knife. And the providence of God, the doctrine of His providence, is that way. We can just say, "Yeah, I know God is sovereign." But when we say it, and when the word is spoken and you say God is sovereign, what is the thought bubble in your mind? What are you seeing? Just a word? Just a bare, raw power statement? The book of Genesis is so beautiful here. You know, all good stories have bookends. They call them inclusios. In literature. So Beauty and the Beast, every Disney movie pretty much starts in a banquet hall and ends in a banquet hall, right? And it provides some closure So the idea is closure, a beginning and an end. The book of Genesis has an inclusio to it that I feel like most people have never seen. How does chapter 1 begin? God creating everything, of course, but remember the refrain, and he saw that it was good, and he saw that it was good, and he saw that it was good. But then there's one day where it doesn't say he saw that it was good, because the thing he made on that day was sort of irrelevant for man. It's a very man-centered chapter, right? In the good sense of that term, that it's very good when man is created. But then you get to chapter 2, and it goes on. It's not good for man to be alone. So God makes a woman. And then you get to chapter 3. And you no longer have God determining what is good for man. You have man. Eve saw that the tree was a delight to the eyes and good for food and to make one wise. So she acted on that. So you have a shift, right? The story begins, God seeing what's good for man, and sin that messed everything up is the opposite. So you could put it this way, at the beginning of Genesis you have, from man's perspective, something that is good that looks evil. Eve, it didn't look good to her. It looked better to do it this way. And at the end, what we see in Joseph's statement, that story of Joseph, how do you think it looked to him? He was going out to just check on his brothers. We don't read of any kind of ill will. For all he know, he was an innocent, sweet child going out there, and they wanted to kill him. They wanted to kill him. He had to be rescued by a couple of his brothers. They wanted to kill him. And they threw him into a pit. I've had some bad arguments with my brother. He never threw me into a pit. You may say, well, mine did. I don't know. But then he probably didn't sell you into slavery. And imagine that. You're gone. They come back and lie. He's dead. A beast ate him. Seemed like everything's out of control for Joseph. And going exactly horrible, perfectly bad, goes down, bought by Potiphar, has to serve this guy. His wife lies about him. There's no justice system in Egypt. They just lynch you. So he's thrown into a prison, worse, dungeon. Finally get this guy. Maybe he will finally remember me. Please remember me, you know, when you get up there. No, forgot him. I mean, how do we think all that look? We read Genesis real quick. It's a quick read, right? But it's years that all that was happening. Years. I imagine it looked evil. As a matter of fact, it was evil, right? It's what Jacob said, at least the brothers said, your father said, for they did you wrong. They did you evil. But what did Joseph see? That's a contrast to the beginning of the book. What did we say was taking place at the beginning of the book? We said that something looked evil, but it was really good. Looked evil to Eve, but it was really good. the end of the book, we see man look upon something and it looks evil, but it is really good. What is the lesson? I don't know about you, but I would not want to get into an airplane where a pilot pulled the stick up when he needed to go down, and he pulled it down when he needed to go up. Well, there is something broken about our minds, or at least limited about them, right? That we could call something evil, and it is actually good, and then call something good, and it is actually evil. You couldn't be more wrong. And I think that's why Proverbs 3 gives us the exhortation to lean not on your own understanding, but instead trust in the Lord with all your heart, and He'll make the path straight. Joseph realized somewhere along the way, we don't know where, it doesn't tell us. Somewhere along the way, he realized not just that his mind was broken and that what he could call evil was actually good and good was actually evil, but the inclusio here, amazing thing about redemption, is the reader is supposed to see God is still doing at the end of the book what he did at the beginning. Separating the seas, creating this and that and the other, because it's good for man. Joseph sees he never stopped doing that. And he even is using evil for good. And it frees him to forgive them. So you want to know what it will do if you or me actually believed in providence? It says in verse 21, he says to them, "So therefore..." How do you become a forgiving person? You can't do it without providence. There's a doctrinal link here. It's after he says, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it." It, the very same act. God was in control of it the whole time, and accomplishing good through it the whole time. So he says, "Therefore, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your little ones." So he comforted them. Don't beat yourselves up. Get up from the ground. I'm not upset. Why should I be upset? If a personal, absolute, all-knowing, almighty, all-wise Father is ruling over my life. It's the same as that little baby saying, "Why should I be upset? If the one woman in the whole world who loves me more than every other woman in the whole world is picking out my bows or picking out my medicine that tastes bad for a minute, This is a picture of Christ. You know that. But let me finish by reading it to you in Acts chapter 2. Verse 22. This is the preaching of Peter. Preaching of Peter on Pentecost. He says, "Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus the Nazarene, a man attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs." So there's the coat of many colors. God had favor on Jesus, unlike any other man, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. And then he says, "This man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men." What is that? How do you put those together? This is why Spurgeon made the famous quote. "Spurgeon, how do you reconcile God's sovereignty and human responsibility?" "I don't reconcile, friends. Everywhere you find them in Scripture, they're together. Look at this. The cross, the most wicked and godless and culpable act that has ever occurred. It has the strength of 70 million abortions in this one deed." He says, absolutely clear, that it occurred, you delivered him over by a predetermined plan. We read in Revelation, there's a book of the life of the Lamb who was slain before the foundation of the world. And then he turns right around and points the finger in them. "You put him to death as though they're guilty." He does it again in chapter 4. It was a staple of his preaching. Look at Acts 4:27. This is all the saints together, this time in a prayer meeting. What would it look like to be biblical? Let's go back to the early church. Okay, we want everyone to pray like this. In the middle of their prayer, they say, "For truly," this is Acts 4:27, "in this city there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, whom you anointed," who all was gathered together? Herod, Pontius Pilate, the Gentiles, peoples of Israel. Sounds just like Joseph. "Brothers are against you. Potiphar's against you. Egypt is against you. Heck, even the chief baker doesn't care about you." Similar to Jesus, even the criminals are cursing you on the tree. And then he says, "They were gathered together to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur." Do you know how the story ends? Jesus discloses himself to his brothers after his exaltation. Right? Just like Joseph. Who is that on the beach over there? And then it's revealed. And they were terrified. But he came to them every time and spoke kindly to them and said, "Peace be with you." First words, every time I come into the room, "Peace be with you." Now, how? Peter tells us. Peter wrote about it in 1 Peter 2. It says, while he was being reviled, while all those things were happening to him, it says, we know that he uttered no threats and he kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. What did he say? No one takes the life from me. Y'all are all going to leave me alone, but I'm not alone. The Father is with me. To the very end, what did he say? Into your hands, your almighty, all-wise, all-loving hands, I commit my spirit. And then Peter exhorts us to the same in chapter 4 of 1 Peter. Let those entrust themselves to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. So the story is, you and I have sinned in this world. You and I meant to sin in this world. You and I have sinned when our consciences were on fire in this world and did it anyway. You and I have sinned when we were caught and someone argued us down and we would not admit it. And so of us can be said, we meant evil. Adam meant evil. Eve meant evil. Everybody in this room meant evil. But God had a book before he created the world, the book of the life of the Lamb who was slain. And the thing Joseph's brothers had to come to terms with was this. While they were committing the wicked deed, God was preparing to feed them. God used their own sin to feed them. That's a different kind of goodness. It's a different kind of goodness. I mean, we say something as Paul says it, right? And Romans 7:13, sin is exceedingly sinful whenever it takes that which was meant for good and causes it to be a cause of death. Like, how wicked are you if you put little needles in Halloween candy and hurt little children, which people do, right? Candy, which is meant for good or ought to have a good time, until you bite into that Tootsie Roll and... What do we say when we hear that? Whoever would hide needles in candy and give it to little children is wicked. Right? Flip it around. If your evil is put on display because you take that which is meant for good and do evil with it, how good are you and must you be if you take that which is meant for evil and do good with it? That's why God ordained evil. Evil is not good, but it is good that evil is. Otherwise, it would not be. Because a good God created the universe. And that's why we call that day, that evil day, Good Friday. So, it was not hard for me to think through as a pastor, how could we this morning segue this into the Lord's Supper? First of all, I hope it's settled for you now when someone says to you, well, isn't predestination deterministic? Thankfully so. That we're not all under the control of chance and rocks and genes and molecules and protons and math. I never liked math anyway, right? What does it look like for God to be in control of your destiny? I'll tell you this morning what it looks like. It looks like you holding a cup that represents the blood of the Son of God. And a piece of bread that represents the body of the Son of God. That's what it looks like. For God to control everything. That's what it looks like. And ask yourself while you're holding it, would you like to change it? There are days that if I had all power, I could show you a few things that I would change. But if I had all wisdom, I would leave them as they are. For God to be in control of all things, it looks like sinners holding the elements of the Lord's Supper. And all of the sin that has ever been committed in this world. You and I are like those brothers. We sit there. It was all committed so that a Savior could come to preserve many people as it is this day. And the Savior of our souls, the one who created us, comes to even us and speaks kindly to us and says, peace be with you. Be at peace. Do not be angry at yourself. Jesus says he's not angry that God controlled all of his life. What a thing. What a doctrine. What a thought to carry in your mind as you hold this cup and hold this bread for a few moments before we take it. To think with Paul, he that did not spare his own son, but gave him over for us all. He that did this with his control over my life. I have to be able to trust it with the rest. Let's take the Lord's Supper.